wanting good money here before this.
There's somebody who's still talking behind us. I'm waiting for Honorable Khaled to try to finish on her phone. She's a BEE, she's got two cell phones. Remember, I've come to a situation where I don't think we ever started the terms that we put down. But maybe when we put terms down, it's just a way of saying that this is the term that we need to prepare ourselves, then we'll start 20 minutes later. So I'm trying to say I apologize like once again, but next time I'm not going to apologize. But we know that if you say 9 o'clock, we're talking about 20 past 9. But let's start now. I think CMS is ready. They got lost and they're ready. For you guys, why don't you settle down now? Is there something that is problematic? Is CMS ready for with their gadget? You got lost and you found the place ultimately. Okay, thank you. Members of God, there's only one thing on the agenda. We're going to be listening to Council of Medical Aid Schemes telling us of what has happened in the year 2009-2010. And that's what we're going to be doing. I think everybody agrees that the biggest challenge of South Africa, and everybody is looking at us as South Africans, is how we're going to be able to solve the inequities, the inequalities that we have in South Africa, which were not made by us, the present people who are leading government, but it's something that we inherited. But it's a huge challenge as to how do we solve it. And as we are talking, a lot of people who can afford to pay for themselves decided that they will pay for health services themselves. And in so doing, the employers decided to contribute something towards that. And government, being an employer too, is contributing a lot of money towards those who can pay for themselves, to continue paying for themselves. But those who are poor are not able to pay for themselves, and they depend on whatever that we're doing as a public health system. So we know that it's 8.1 million people that are paying for themselves, and they are subsidized to continue paying for themselves. But it's a huge challenge as to how are we going to bridge that gap. And the whole world is looking at us as how we're going to do that. It's a big challenge. Now, because there are medical aid schemes who are paying for those members that have joined them, and we are subsidizing them, we want to know. We thought that it was important that they must be regulated, because they were not regulated before. And I suspect, over and above what you're going to tell us what you're doing, is how do you transform such that we look forward to a situation where even those that are poor can have a good healthcare system in South Africa. Because the belief that I have as a person is that if you've got those areas where the people are not healthy, those that are not healthy are going to affect those that are healthy. And we're going to remain in the same problem. And I've got a belief that the health indicators that we have in South Africa that are bad, everybody agrees that are bad. And I'm told, I can confirm that we are the highest on TB in the whole world. We are number one. And I think it's a reflection. It's a reflection of these inequities. So we're hoping that CMS would actually assist us. Not that we're saying the medicalism must stop, but if you can regulate them such that you help us in finding that solution. We know you can't. You won't be able but to come with suggestions. So I'm just mentioning this because you are going to be talking to us, but our interest is just to know the little money that you get from government, because I think it's little, most of the money you are getting from the medical aid themselves. So the little money that you are getting from government, and even that one that you are getting from the medical aid, because it's actually the money that comes from membership and this contribution from government, how have you used it? What are you doing? This is why we called you today. I'm hoping that it's going to be a very short meeting, but if it's long, it will depend on the members themselves, if they want to ask a lot of questions. But if they don't, it will be very short. I want to request members that as soon as we finish with CMS, we can sit down just for a few minutes so that we can give reports of some of the things that we discussed yesterday. As members, only those that are elected. We're not talking about those who have applied for jobs and they got them. We're talking about those who are elected by people. So I think we are going to give over to a Council of Medical Aid Schemes to tell us what they're doing. But before we do that, I see there are some new faces, people that I don't know. But let me tell you who is here, the members that are here, so that you know. You might forget all the names that I'm going to be mentioning, but it doesn't matter. As long as you call them honorable members. I'm not sure whether they're honorable members or they're honest members. I tend to think that HON means honest members. They're honest members. So we've got the whip of the committee, Ibrahim Suleiman, who's sitting next to me. Next to her, we've got Honorable Dube. Next to Honorable Dube, we've got Honorable Dr. Albert Lutuli sitting there. On the other side, we've got Honorable Sekgale Deswai. Next to Mam Sekgale Deswai, we've got Honorable Mtsweli. Then I've got to go beyond. I don't know how he was sitting this way. Then we've got Honorable Mike Waters sitting beyond the Council for Medical Aid Schemes. Beyond him, we've got Honorable More or Mo. Or Mohen is closer. You can say Mohen, you can say Mo, you can say More. It's up to you how you pronounce it. So those are the members that are here. We think that we're forming a quorum that is going to be able to engage you in all the things that you are telling us. I see that you've got some new faces. I thought I knew everybody in the Council for Medical Aid Schemes, but it seems as if there are new faces that I don't know. I think beyond Prof. I see two faces that I know. I've never seen those two faces. I'm seeing them for the first time. I want to know who they are. But I'm told, Chairperson, that you've got two tablehors for some reason that I don't know. How do you get two tablehors? A female tablehore and a male tablehore. It's a bisexual name. Okay. No, maybe you can tell us who is here, as long as we can remember that part, which for me, I'm very passionate about that. That the whole world is looking at South Africa. How do we bridge this big gap? And in fact, from 1994 to date, it has widened a little bit. And we need to find a solution. How do we bridge it? Okay, I'll give over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, for the opportunity yet again to share with you what we try to do with the Council for Medical Schemes as we regulate these schemes in South Africa. Before I start, just to tell you that the two new faces to my right are members of council. And I'm very pleased that councillors themselves find the time to come to Parliament and to share with the staff as they present to you, discuss and engage with you. I have to my immediate right Professor Ronald Green Thompson, who I'm sure you're familiar with. And then to his right, Mr. Tabakhul Pardu, who is in fact, both of them are new council members and both are representing us here today. I'm going to hand over to the Registrar of Council for him to lead us through the process, and I would also urge presenters to take account of your time constraints, if you don't have too much time spent on the presentation, if you can, without missing out on key elements of our presentation. So over to the Registrar.
Maybe I must say, the last time we met you, you talked about some challenges, especially those that have got to do with amendments of bills or acts. We have taken this to the department. As you know, most of the laws are started by the department. We have talked to them, though we didn't have enough facts, because I was still supposed to meet Craig and see. So I'm telling you that what we talked about is in process. We're going to be able to we think that we're going to be able to handle it. So I just wanted to give you that information. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson of the Health Portfolio Committee, for the opportunity for us to make a presentation to the committee. My name is Monwabi Siganjo, the registrar and the CEO of the Council for Medical Skills.
You don't have to say that name of Monwabi.
probably have to patent the copyrighted chapter. Let me introduce to the committee members and the honourable members the management team of the Council for Medical Schemes. On my immediate left, I've got Daniel Lewucho, who is the Chief Financial Officer of the Council for Medical Schemes. On my immediate right, it's Tebogo Mazia, who is then the head of the Financial Supervision Unit of the Council. Next to her is Mr. Craig Barton-Durham, who is the head of the Legal Services. And that completes our presentation. I'm going to take you through very briefly, the state of affairs of the Council as it relates to the annual report 2009-2010 in front of you. The period that is covered there would naturally belong to give a full picture of the activities of the Council as a mandated regulatory body of the Department of Health and the Ministry of Health in South Africa. The presentation will then go through. The trends, and you'll see as we're going along what has been happening over the past 10 years as well. Although the emphasis this time around is going to be on the last financial year, we hope that at the end of this presentation we'll be able to share with you the state of affairs when it comes to private healthcare in this country. One, two, will share with you the challenges that we have experienced from that front. We also hope that at the end of this, we'll be able to give some clues and views on how to deal with the solutions of those challenges, as we have ably outlined, Chairperson. The financial year, therefore, is from the 1st of April 2009 to 31st of March 2010, during which period we've had two acting registrars and before my appointment on the 1st of June. The first 10 years of the activities of the Council are in the annual report itself, which was translated to the member. In the overview, we will then deal with the financial aspects, non-financial information that is relevant to the industry, and of course the financial one. And lastly, we'll talk about just the current issues of the Council for Medical Schemes, the challenges and the solutions and assistance that we think the Council can, and we believe that we have got a lot of contribution to make in making these happen. The medical schemes industry in South Africa is a very complex one. We are all aware that this is a huge, multi-billion rand industry, 84.9 in contributions alone, just to be precise in that regard. It covers 8.1 million lives as we speak right now, 2 or 3 weeks ago. That's the kind of statistics that we're having. At the end, during the period in review, there were 110 of these medical schemes. As we speak right now, it's 105. In the next 2 weeks, there will probably be 103 medical aid schemes, if I were to come into the latest information. Our mandate, as it is stipulated in the Medical Schemes Act, specifically wants us to protect the beneficiaries of the medical schemes and the public. I'll come to that in a minute. But there's also an important aspect which talks to the long-term sustainability of the industry. We monitor, as our mandate, we monitor, we control, we supervise this industry. Medical schemes, administrators, managed care organizations, and health brokers. The last part, which is the health broker, is an area that we will talk as well, and we probably will need some guidance from various quarters, because the brokers would both health care and non-health care, and there's two regulatory bodies that are involved in that. Ourselves, the CMS and the FSB, that immediately sells chairperson, that's the two departments are involved in the healthcare procuration, all the challenges that emanate from that, that is the Department of Health and the Department of Finance. There are pillars that underpin this regulatory mandate that we're having. And these pillars ordinarily and in fact specifically speak to the principle of open enrollment, community rating as opposed to risk rating. And this tool that is used and that we use as a council is the tool, an important tool, which is the prescribed minimum benefits that are in the Act and regulated, specifically regulation number 8. The second one is the risk equalization fund. Risk equalization fund to look at the whole issue of sustainability of the medical systems and the aging and the age differentiation that you find. And in order to compensate those schemes that probably have got a high burden of disease due to the chronicity of the nature of the disease that members have or the age that they are having. The next important pillar is the governance of the medical aid schemes and compliance. Many of the challenges that we are facing is that some of the medical schemes are found wanting when it comes to proper governance structures. We've got systems in place to make sure that they comply so that the public and the beneficiaries out there are well protected. The issue of cost containment, which is affordability of the general public to afford private health care, is one of the pillars that we have to guard against and nurture. Fairness in the treatment of the beneficiaries and public. The experience that we have over the past few years, including the last year, that is the year under review, are the complaints, and this is how we judge our effectiveness, and this is also how we judge the way in which we dispense our mandate and the response that we're getting in from the general public. And we have briefly summarized this as 10 top 10 complaints that we are experiencing. Top in the list is the issue of that medical aid schemes seem, for some reason, as we are getting a response, that are not paying the accounts that are being given. And to them, that constitute for 37.2% of the total complaints that we have. It. The second one is the refusal by the schemes to issue authorization for people who seek these the services that they have paid and contributed for. And that would then account for 10.2% of the total complaints that we have received. Now, this is a whole list of the complaints that we are getting as a response from the general public and the beneficiaries, the members of the medical schemes in particular. In addition to those two that I have mentioned, one of the complaints that we are having is the fact that the PMBs that I referred earlier on, prescribed minimum benefits, formularies and DSPs, the problems relating to those DSPs means designated service providers that the schemes would designate to serve their members, and the formularies that they would set put out there in order to treat the patient. And the others are there for you to see, reversal and short-term payment accounts, administrative inefficiencies. There are inefficiencies in the private healthcare sector, and we know and we have got evidence to this effect, whilst there is also a service rendered by them. I'm going to hand over to the Chief Financial Officer, who is then going to take you through the last financial year, indicating what are the cost areas, what are the revenues, and how the inefficiencies, how do we relate to the auditor general and the report thereof. After him, the head of the financial supervision unit will take the committee members through the trends that have been established over this period on the solvency issues, on the members of the medical schemes that we have, what has been influencing them in many ways. Out of that information, we will then be able, Chairperson, to say, and very confidently, as Councillor for Medical Skin, that the skills, the experience, and the capacity that the Council has is willing and it is ready to participate in any healthcare system that we will have in the country. We will contribute in any way that we are asked to do, given the kind of the expertise and the skill that we're having. Without wasting much time, I'm going to ask Debo Hall to take us through the financial and non-financial aspects of the Council for Medical Skills. Over to you.
It's actually Dan's turn.
Oh, yeah, sorry, it's right, Dan, right, okay.
Thank you, Chair. We're reporting in terms of our financial management for the year 2009 and 2010. And we want to indicate that we've received a clean audit from the Auditor General. And we've indicated even in the last meeting with yourself that it's because we've managed to put some good internal controls in the council over the years, and that we comply with the Public Finance Management Act in terms of.
You know, you're talking about the clean audit, which is very good. Which we want to congratulate you on that. The clean audit, as we understand, sometimes politicians are not very brilliant. We were told that it's where the financial receipts have been compiled properly and serviced. There's proper service, so everything has happened. Now, I'm looking at it on the CMS, the Council for Medical Skills. Does it mean that you have done what you needed to do, the fact that you have got a clean audit? It's not about receipts only, but, and I'm trying to say, what is your service that you think that you have done well?
If you tell us now, so don't wait until the end.
Okay, sir. If you look at our annual report as well, we've got a performance information report. The performance information report indicates the objectives that we set ourselves for at the beginning of the financial year and what we have achieved against those objectives. And in that regard as well, also the Auditor General has given us a clean audit in that regard. We've performed according to the objectives that we set ourselves for. We've outlined our seven strategies.
Meaning that when I join the medical aid, they are not going to look at the risk that I have, that I have got that, they just look at that as a human being.
Yes. Because what Dr. Gonch had been referring to, the open enrollment thing, that's what we are enforcing in terms of the utility. The open enrollment means every member of the public can join the medical team, irrespective of his health status or whatever. So that is what we are enforcing in terms of the utilization of these resources. Yes.
So you can go and work in the Department of Health and give them a good.
Yes, we can advise them on how to do it. And also, Chair, you know, we've been legally challenged. That's why we're pointing to our legal teams that this one area that when we take decisions, the skills do not necessarily always agree with our decisions, and they take us to court and whatever. And this one area we're spending money on. We're also investigating the affairs, the governance of the schemes also. So we also appoint him to that particular expenditure in that regard. Yes, Chair. Okay. In that regard, Chair, we're pointing out to our major expenditure items. But let me first start with the revenue, how we collected the revenue in the previous financial year. Our revenue is mainly from the levies from schemes. Our levy rate last year was about $15.42 per member per annum. So we've collected about 52 million. That is our main source of revenue. And the other revenue was accreditation fees from the brokers. When a broker is supposed to offer medical advice to members of the public, he must be accredited with us for a period of 2 years. for which they pay about 8,004 for the 2 years. So those are our main source of revenue in respect of our operations. And we have received money from the government in respect of the risk equalization fund. As at the previous financial, the risk equalization fund was always funded by a grant from the medical aid scheme. We have now taken it over going forward in this financial year 2010-2011. So in that regard, we have now built it in terms of the levy on medical aid scheme. Now our major expenditures, we are pointing out there that some of our expenditures relate to our audit fees, which is conducted by the Auditor General. As you're indicating, they are happy that we've complied with all the requirements of the Public Finance Management Act. They are also happy that we have managed our finance in terms of the generally recognized accounting practices and all other relevant legislation applicable to the financial management in the public sector arena. As you are aware, we are a Schedule 3 public entity in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. So in a sense, we are accounting for our finances in terms of that legislation. That is our main Bible in terms of accounting for our finances. The other expenditure that we've incurred is in relation to our consumer education. Our consumers are mainly the members of the scheme, so that they need to be informed about the work we do. So we always have got people out there, the outreach programs, where they talk to our members, explaining to them what we do, what they have to do in terms of them having complaints, and what recourse they may have as far as our office is concerned. And the other expenditure item that I want to highlight is in relation to our HR organization strategy. Our approach is that we put our employees first, so that our success of our organization over the years has been that we nurture the talent that we have in the organization. In that regard, we've got strategies like succession planning, career pathing, remuneration strategies. So that the organizational strategy aspect of our expenditure speaks to those kind of projects. Investigation costs have indicated that when schemes do not comply with the Act, we will go out there and investigate the operations. And the legal fees also, I've alluded to that. Media and promotion in the main is the publication of our annual report. We spent about 524,000 in terms of compiling our annual report, which has been distributed to yourselves as well. Strategic planning costs as well. In order for us to look forward to the next financial year, we always meet as senior management and council to plan for the year ahead, to look into what kind of strategic objectives we want to pursue in the following year. And also the trustee training, we go out there and give guidance to trustees in terms of how we want them to manage schemes in terms of good corporate governance principles as they exist in the country. We've alluded in the previous presentation that the King 3 has just been released. We want to adopt the model as best practices in terms of King 3 to institutionalize this in the management of the affairs of the scheme, which is best practice in this country. And the other major cost is the staff cost, which include our salaries, employee staff training, employee wellness, and the temporary recruitment of our staff members. So those are some of our major expenditure items, Chair. And we've put in a pie chart just to show in terms of percentage share in relation to the revenue that we've collected. As you can see, staff costs, they account for a bigger chunk of our expenditure item, is about 55%, and we indicated that the rental for the building, which represent about 5%, the audit fees, as I've indicated, the consumer education. Those are our main important expenditure items in terms of that pie chart, as they have been contained in our financial statement. Chairperson, in terms of financial presentation, we've got the balance sheet, as you see. We've got the income statement. We've also got the cash flow statement, which contains all these figures that I've pointed out to. And we can confirm that because they've been audited, we've actually presented them in accordance with the generally recognized accounting practices. I do not want to take you through each and every statement there, but just to indicate that we've complied with all the requirements of the audit function. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. If I may, we'll then proceed to the legal and legislative framework in which we work as a Council for Medical Schemes. Ourselves being a creature of statute with an enabling act in the form of the Medical Schemes Act and other related acts, we have got a legal obligation and we have got a legal responsibilities and legislative accountabilities that I'm going to ask Craig, the head of the legal services, to take us through.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. I'm really just going to dwell very briefly on the 10 years. As you know, the Council for Medical Schemes has been in existence now for 10 years, and really just to briefly take you through some of the areas which have loomed large in being important during this period under review. Also, just to mention again, you know, that the prime role of the Council is the protection of members. Members are central to our regulatory framework, and as the Registrar has rightly mentioned, we are a creature of statute, and therefore our rights and our obligations are clearly defined in the Medical Schemes Act. I can maybe start on the point of governance. You know, medical schemes are mutual societies, they trust, and they're governed by boards of trustees who bear a fiduciary responsibility toward the members of those schemes. And 10 years ago, when the Act as it's currently framed came into effect, the trustees were called to the office to obviously explain the situation regarding schemes and schemes certainly that were underperforming. And it was quite interesting to note how a common theme was trustees who were surprised and who were taken aback that they were being held accountable and were being taken to task by the regulator, when in fact they believed that there were other third parties who really should be answering those questions, namely administrators and others who were intimately involved in the day-to-day governance or the day-to-day payment of claims, contributions and so on. And there's been a very big paradigm shift, I think, in this area. And one of the common themes, I think, over the 10 years has been the extent to which the Council has ensured and has effected and enforced good corporate governance, both through your legislative reform, introducing amendments to the Act, and also by way of trustee training programs that have been put in place to make trustees very aware of what their fiduciary responsibilities are, and more importantly, what the consequences are of not governing these medical schemes in the interests of their members. So fiduciary responsibility has been a key part of corporate governance, and I think we've come a long way in terms of the extent to which trustees now know what the consequences and the implications of accepting trusteeship are. Together with that, we also found at the time that there was massive reinsurance in a number of areas where schemes were reinsured to the extent that the solvency levels that were prescribed by the Medical Schemes Act weren't in fact in place. And you found in place of the requisite prescribed solvency, which is 25%, my colleague will talk to that, I think, just now when she presents, but you found that the reinsurance was a problem at the time. And that was another project which the regulator then tackled. And reduced that. We also, by way of legislative reform, introduced a provision which very, very strictly controls now the use of reinsurance in this particular environment, because medical schemes are required to have solvency levels within the scheme, and those funds must be managed within the scheme and not be either, you know, sitting in another vehicle or sitting outside the scheme and have reinsurance in place of what is required. So that's also been a common theme and something that's taken quite a bit of work during the past decade. I've mentioned solvency, and as I've indicated, that was to an extent linked to the use and abuse, as we identified it, of reinsurance. There's been a very strict focus on solvency and solvency building by medical schemes during the period, and I think one will see how that solvency has increased over time to the extent that medical schemes have reached and have achieved their solvency target. To the extent that they haven't, there were a number of measures introduced, including close monitoring of medical schemes that don't meet those solvency requirements, through the Financial Supervision Unit and the Registrar's Office taking a very careful note of those instances and ensuring that those schemes report to the office as they're required to do, and indicate very, very clearly what plans are in place to ensure that the requisite solvency is reached. And the reason being obvious that medical schemes require that solvency in order to serve the interests of those members and to ensure that their healthcare needs are met. In addition to that, we also put a risk assessment framework in place where schemes were assessed in terms of the risk which they would pose in the environment if there were problems, experience, and difficulties with those particular schemes and what the impact of those schemes would be in the environment as a whole. So it was a holistic view that was taken, and a lot of work was done in putting a risk assessment framework in place, and that of course guides the regulator in terms of where the areas of priority are and the sort of interventions that are required. The registrar since ceiling office is also very interested in exploring at the moment as we speak the possibilities of us having a real-time monitoring system on that specific aspect, and together with the information technology unit at the office, that's also something that will be taken forward. Prescribed minimum benefits, I think, has been something that's enjoyed quite a bit of coverage of late. These are benefits that all medical schemes are required to provide their members, and they're also required to provide them in full without co-payments or the use of deductibles, meaning that, of course, a member cannot be prejudiced when a prescribed minimum benefit is at stake. And a very, very important function of prescribed minimum benefits, when you look at the intention of the legislature and the Act, was to ensure that members of medical schemes in these particular areas are not dumped on the public sector, that they're properly taken care of by these medical schemes within that framework. And that's been the subject of some considerable work at the office as well, including a task team recently that has been initiated, which the registrar has played a very active role in ensuring that these benefits are properly rendered to members of medical schemes. Then there's been the issue of the reference price list, I think, which everybody has taken note of. It's something which falls within the purview of the Department of Health. But the Council for Medical Schemes, during a phase of its 10-year existence, took responsibility for it and delegated to us. And it then reverted back to the Department of Health. I think we're all aware that the Minister of Health published an inflator on the... at the request of the Minister, we published an inflator on our website during the course of the recent court case, which took some considerable time to resolve in the High Court. And to that extent, we've also had an interest, of course, in the reference price list process. And there are a number of other processes in place at the office at the moment in terms of looking at pricing in this sector, which I think is a critical part of health insurance, is the pricing, the costs that are incurred and the costs that are charged in this particular area. The risk equalization fund, the registrar has already referred to, and that was a project which was undertaken during the 10-year period on a delegated basis from the Department of Health. It was also funded on a project basis by the department, and the clear purpose of a risk equalization fund being to obviously equalize and smooth the risk that schemes face as a whole, due to the fact that the Medical Schemes Amendment Bill didn't pass into law, that particular process and the legislation around that hasn't come into effect as we speak. Then, of course, on the international classification of diseases, which are carefully followed, and codes are required to be appended to claims that are lodged with medical schemes, our research and monitoring unit has played a very integral role in exploring these specific aspects and also engaging with us in order to ensure that the codes that are rendered contain the correct international classification, and that's also an ongoing work over the period. We are also responsible for the accreditation of brokers. The registrar has made reference to brokers and the role of brokers in this environment. In addition to the accreditation of administrators and managed care organizations, who are required to demonstrate to the regulator that they, in fact, are financially stable and capable of rendering the services which they are required to render. Very importantly, I think, just to mention here, is a process where the council has increasingly interrogated, I think, and started to question the value-add component which these entities bring to medical schemes. So it's not just a case of them being financially sound and able to render the service, the question is there a value add component to that? And I think the focus, a clear focus on that to ensure that as part of the accreditation, council really wants to be satisfied that is the case. We built up an extensive accreditation database as well of the entities, the various entities over time, including the brokers that have been accredited. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, once more. The last part of the presentation will be dealing with the real nitty-gritties of how the financial and non-financial trends we have observed over a period of time. That kind of a data and statistics will be very helpful as we go about strategizing on how to bring in solutions to the challenges that we have. The trend that we'll go through, that Deboko is going to take us through, will be relating to the numbers of the medical schemes that we have, the beneficiaries and members that we have in, non-financial costs that we have in, that we have observed, non-healthcare expenditures that we have, and out of that, we'll then be able to share views as we're going along in dealing with the challenge that we have over to you.
The last part that they are giving us now, it's not given to a lady because it's one of the ladies. It's the most important they will have. So, and the part that they are giving us, the most important part of the
family. Yes, yes. I'll be taking you through the first bit is going to be on the non-financial information of medical schemes, and those are the various aspects that I'll cover under it. This speaks to the number of medical schemes. As at the end of 2009, we had 110 medical schemes, down from 114. And the reason we saw that reduction is due to a couple of voluntary liquidations, largely due to unsustainability of medical schemes from a risk pool point of view. So the schemes were too small to be sustainable, you know, from... Again, the trend over 10 years, you'll see that there's a general decline over the 10 years, again speaking to the sort of consolidation that we have seen in the market. Membership, we had 8.1 lives covered as at the end of 2009, and 3.5 of which were principal members. You'll also note that the largest increase in number of lives covered was in the restricted market, and open schemes saw a decline of 1.5%. And that's obviously the impact of GEMS. GEMS is the one scheme that had the biggest growth, which is why you see that sort of increase there. Trends over the last 10 years, again, the red line is for restricted schemes. And from about 2006, you'll see that upward trend. That's when GEMS started operating. And with that slight decline there in open schemes. Because what's currently happening is that on the schemes that were traditionally designed for government-type employees, those people are slowly leaving to join GEMS. And that is why the overall membership follows that of the same trend as restricted schemes. Demographic profile. Demographic profile. You will note that open schemes are getting older, and restricted schemes are, the numbers in brackets are last year's figures. So that's 2008 in brackets, and then that's 2009. Open schemes are getting older, and restricted schemes are getting younger. Overall, the industry has remained more or less the same. But you see also that that's the pensioner ratio. So the number of people over 65 years. Again, a similar trend in that it's higher for restricted schemes, for open schemes, than it is for restricted schemes. The other reason why open schemes have seen such an increase in the pensioner ratio is due to one or two schemes that changed their systems and therefore resulting in a very dramatic impact on the aging. So part of that of that increase is artificial, actually. There was also one scheme which had a very bad marketing campaign, and again, it led to a very dramatic impact on their aging. Average age of beneficiaries, open schemes, as indicated in the previous slide, are higher than restricted schemes. That purple line over there is where restricted schemes would be without GEMS, so it excludes GEMS, which is why it's higher than where it is now. The red line is with GEMS. So because it's getting younger members, that's why you see that downward trend there. The purple one is excluding GEMS, restricted schemes excluding GEMS, again showing the impact of GEMS on the market. This slide is the distribution of benefits across the various providers. Hospitals account for the largest component of benefits paid in 2009, followed by specialists and medicines. Together, they account for just over 50% of total benefits paid. The three disciplines indicated account for over 50% of benefits paid. 10-year trend, and it follows, again, hospitals. The orange line there is hospitals, which is clearly outpacing other benefits. That's specialists, that's medicines. So it follows exactly the same trend as the previous slide. This is the same slide, except that it's shown per beneficiary per month. So per life covered per month, those are the sort of costs that you saw there. So per about 290 per beneficiary per month on hospitals. This slide speaks to utilization of services. The columns to watch are the consolidated columns, because it tells you overall what happened per discipline, and you will see that there was on various sectors there was an increase in the utilization of services by members of medical schemes. However, as you will see in later slides, utilization alone does not necessarily explain why we saw the sort of cost increases that we saw in the industry. It more relates to tariff issues and pricing issues that we are all aware of. The next bit of the presentation speaks to the financial data, and those are the various areas that will cover contributions, benefits, non-health expenditure, and overall financial soundness of the industry. Contributions increased by 14.5% to 84.9 billion, and claims increased by a higher 17.6% to 26.3 billion overall. A similar trend is noted when you look at both the risk pool and the savings pool. Risk is when you exclude savings. As indicated earlier, the part of the reason why claims have increased by more than contributions is because of factors like aging, utilization, and obviously the cost pressures, you know, in terms of the various disciplines. But what it also means is that the average medical scheme member actually got more value for money because more was paid in benefits. And it's also indicated by the higher claims ratio. It used to be 88. Claims ratio is claims as a function of contributions. It was about 87% last year, is now closer to 90%, meaning more money was spent on benefits. The red bar is contributions, claims, risk contributions, meaning excluding savings, and then risk claims, and then the green line is your claims ratio over time. What has happened is that you see that from about 2000 to 2004, there was a downward trend in the claims ratio. Claims ratio, again, is claims as a function of contributions. And during that period, that's the reserve building period, so it appears as if there was a trade-off between reserving and claims. So reserves were built at the expense of claims over that period, because that's the period in which medical schemes needed to build up to 25%. 2004 was the introduction of PMDs and CDLs, as well as chronic disease lists, as well as the deregulation of prices by the Competition Commission, which is why you see that increase in claims, in the claims ratio. 2006 was when we saw a trend of co-payments and self-payment gaps introduced by the industry, which is why you see that what was paid by scheme went down, meaning more was paid out of pocket. And this year, we saw an upward surge in claims again due to the factors that are indicated, such as utilization, aging of the industry, as well as the cost pressures that we alluded to earlier. Non-healthcare expenditure. The biggest component of non-health is your gross admin, which is things like administrator fees, trustee fees, and other operating costs. And we saw an increase in open schemes of 9.1% to 140, and an increase in restricted schemes of 10.3% to 71.6%. Part of the reason why the increase in restricted is higher is obviously because there's higher volumes through the growth that we saw in Gen. So there's higher volumes covered in restricted schemes. Trends in non-health expenditure. The red component, which is the biggest, is gross admin. That orange is broker fees, and you can see how it has increased over time from about 2000. That's broker fees there. The green, as Craig indicated, that's reinsurance. And you'll see that from about 2005, there's almost no reinsurance. There's currently only about three medical schemes that have reinsurance as a risk management tool. And this is obviously due to the sort of legislative amendments that were brought through Section 20 of the Act. The blue line there is your bed debt, so the amount of bed debt written off by medical schemes. The other area, the blue, is your managed care management services, so the, not the healthcare expenditure, the admin expenditure on managed care, but we'll speak to that in a later slide. Gross admin increased by 7% to 7.5 billion, and as indicated, the increase in restricted schemes is a higher 19% to 2 billion, compared to a lower increase of 8.7% in open schemes. Managed care management services, these are the sort of interventions that medical schemes utilize to attempt to bring down or manage your claims costs. These would speak to things like your pre-authorization, you know, before you go to hospital, those kind of activities. There was an increase of 15.5% to 1.9. And as Craig indicated, we, as part of the accreditation process of managed care entities, the office has introduced a standard which requires the value-add proposition of such interventions to be demonstrable before the entity can be accredited. And this, of course, is to ensure that medical scheme member monies are being spent on the appropriate interventions. So Board of Trustees need to be really applying their minds before they undertake such interventions. Broker fees. We saw an increase of 1.7 to 1.1 billion. If you look at the next slide, it links broker fees to membership. And you will see that there's almost no relationship between the rate at which membership is growing and the rate at which broker fees are growing. And because the other issue that alludes to that is that we saw an increase of about 3.2 in total number of lives covered in the current year, and that's mostly in the restricted scheme market, which traditionally has no brokerage. So there's almost no linkage between member growth and the broker fees being paid by medical schemes. Impaired receivables, this is your bad debt. You will see that overall they've come down over time, but in the last 2 years, we saw an increase in bad debts written off by medical schemes. This means that some members are not paying their contributions. It could just be an indication of the current economic conditions. But what is good is that medical schemes are also collecting contributions faster. So that even though they're collecting money faster from members, bed debts are rising, which tells you that it's not a system problem in terms of the scheme. It's just an affordability issue. The risk of why I said collecting contributions faster is good is because the risk of not collecting contributions fast is that you will pay claims before contributions are received, therefore placing the scheme at risk. But in terms of overall non-health expenditure, these costs are very negligible. It's a very, very small percentage of non-health expenditure overall. Operating results of medical schemes. That blue line is your clean operating results before inclusion of investment income. The difference between the two lines is investment income, and you can see that medical schemes have continued to rely on investment income to bring them back in the black. That figure there, in 2009, overall operating results were a deficit of about 2.6 billion. When you include investment income, that figure comes up to about 1 billion. So net results for medical schemes were a positive 1 billion after the inclusion of investment income. Again, from about 2000 to 2004, it was increasing because that's the period during which schemes needed to build reserves in terms of Regulation 29 of the Act. During that period, most schemes were above 25% and therefore possibly funding contributions via reserves, meaning providing relief, to members. That year where you see that trend changing, that was largely due to one scheme, the biggest open scheme, Discovery, which had about a 1 billion year-on-year difference in their operating results. 2009, there were two large medical schemes that incurred very big losses. The two of them together account for about 30% of the industry's bottom line in terms of the deficit that they incurred. So two large schemes incurred very big deficits in that year, other than the others. But 2009 generally was a tough year claims-wise for all medical schemes. Solvency. The blue line, that period was the what we call the phase-in period for solvency. So schemes from the promulgation of the Act in 2000, of the Medical Schemes Act, up until 2004, schemes had about 5 years to build up reserves and get to 25%. And currently, any scheme that is registered needs to be at 25%. So that's the statutory requirement. The red line is the actual solvency of medical schemes. From about 2006, you'll see that there's a general decline, part of which can be explained by the fact that as new members are joining GMs, they're not bringing reserves with them, and therefore having this dilutory effect on solvency. But generally, medical schemes are overall still above the 25% required in terms of the Act. This slide gives a breakdown of all schemes that are above 25%. So when it says below prescribed level, that's below 25% as per Regulation 29, and then above 25%. In 2009, there were 16 open schemes below the statutory level, and then there were 6 restricted schemes. The table below that speaks to the number of lives in those schemes that are below 25%. You see that from, if you look at 2008, it had 1 million, just over 1 million in schemes, open schemes below, and now that number is down to 992. But from 2007, the reason you see that decline from 2007 is again because Discovery, which has a lot of lives in the open market, attained solvency. So that's why you see that shift from about 63 to now 20%. The opposite is happening on the restricted side, and that is because of GEMS. GEMS is a new scheme, so it's currently, during it needs to attain phase-in solvency level, And because it's still growing, and those members are not bringing members with them, that's why you see that sort of increase on the restricted side in terms of the number of lives covered. In fact, if you take that figure of 1.2 million lives in restricted schemes, 91% of them is because of GEMS. So the balance of the other schemes is actually very small. And the office has a framework that we allow for schemes that are still growing and need to be growing their reserves as they are gaining members. Okay, I've already spoken to these points to indicate that discovery attained solvency. That's why you saw the drop in the number of lives in open schemes below 25%. This slide speaks to the impact of GEMS in the industry. As indicated, the green line is reserved, I mean, solvency for restricted schemes. The red line is solvency for open schemes. And that drop there is because of members joining GEMS, not bringing reserves with them. That's why from about 2006, when you look at open schemes, there was a slight increase. There was the positive effect of members leaving open schemes to join GEMS, so it was a temporary increase because those members were not taking reserves with them. The two lines at the bottom speak to aging. The pensioner ratio of open schemes at 7.3 is higher than that of restricted schemes, again, because of the sort of demographic profile alluded to earlier. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Tepfor. Thank you, colleagues. Thanks the members, honorable members of Health Portfolio Committee. In conclusion, I think it's proper for me to mention that in just the next 2-3 minutes, Chairperson, I outline to you the way forward and how we intend dealing with some of the challenges and the important data that we have. Attention to details, as you have seen in the few presentations that we've had, and especially the last one, it probably will be speaking to your comments earlier on the choice of the presenters that we have. I'm not saying that men are not paying attention to detail, but I think it's important for itself. Yeah. Of course, the issue of the national health insurance is an important one for all of us. And I've only got this to say in the presence of the council members that we have and my colleagues that the Council for Medical Schemes supports the national health insurance. To that end, the chairperson of council serves in the Ministerial Advisory Committee. One of our senior executives in the office serves in a subcommittee on purchasing. I personally serve in a subcommittee that deals with quality improvement and accreditation. And therefore, that participation goes to show that we take the matter seriously. As I mentioned in earlier on, the intention is for the Council for Medical Schemes to be of assistance and be part of the solution to the challenges that the country has instead of being part of a problem. To that end, we have got the expertise, we have got the capacity, and we have got the skills that has been honed over the past 10 years within the Office of the Medical Schemes to assist in that process. There are issues of draft legislation that should talk to the Medical Schemes Act because, as we know, the Act is still in place. Until the Act is reviewed or amended or struck down or whatever comes out of the process leading, that will the Parliament and the Department of Health and the Ministry move forward. That's an area that we think we can make contributions in. There's day-to-day work that needs to be done by the office and the council that definitely needs amendments to the Act. Some of the changes that we are proposing in the meantime would relate to the definition of what is called the business of a medical scheme. scheme and that talks to the demarcation. The demarcation is an area that currently falls, or it must be addressed to delineate the responsibilities of the medical aid schemes as regulated by the CMS and those health products that we find flooding the market that would then be currently regulated by the FSB, which is the Department of Finance. We have got views in this regard. We have engaged with the Minister of Health, who has understands that a delineation or demarcation, as we call it, needs to take place. He's written to us, giving our full support, which I hope that support also will flow to the Health Portfolio Committee. Then we can deal with the issue of the demarcation of these services that we find Department of Health and the Department of Finance. I have engaged personally with the Registrar of the FSB to get the support and make him understand that many members of the public are at risk and in fact in danger of being promised to be covered for their healthcare needs by a body that is not specializing in healthcare, by a body that its interest fundamentally would be more financial. Whereas in the case of the Council for Medical Schemes, as I have shown in the pillars and the mandate that we have, is to look after the beneficiaries of the medical aid schemes and the public. That is an area that is critical for us. We might have to test this idea in court and making sure that there is a ruling that would seek to protect the general public. The implementation, the REF, is an issue that we still need to get an agreement on between operational aspect of the Council for Medical Schemes, that is ourselves, the governing body, which is the Council, Department of Health as the policy implementer of government, the minister as a policy maker, that in fact the REF, which is Risk Equalization Fund, is a useful tool, especially in the interim, especially in the absence of any other health system that we have. To have it implemented, it will stabilize the first and foremost the industry, and secondly, or if not equally important, protect the aged members of the schemes, and for us to help go through that thin and delicate line between affordability of the healthcare services and the sustainability of a healthcare funder. That is an area that we hope we can discuss it further, and we think that your support will be useful together with the political buy-in and the Department of Health to make sure that the Risk Equalization Fund is addressed, particularly in the interim and in the absence of any other health system. To this end, we have established a very important registry within the office to register all the benefits, to register all the costs that would be attracted by the old versus the young people in the schemes, the sick versus the healthy beneficiaries. We have put that registry in place in order to make sure that the data that we have, which is currently outdated because it dates back to 2005, is not adequate to help. This is an area that when it is implemented, it can also be dumped, if one wants to use that term, as we proceed evolving the healthcare insurance. And I have in mind in here the National Health Insurance, which is currently in the public domain. We're all aware of the risk of the RPL, which is the reference price listing, that was struck down in July this year by the courts. To this end, we have, as part of participating and contributing to solution-finding mechanisms, is an alternative process to arrive at a negotiated medical scheme tariff, so to call multilateral negotiations, must be in place. There is a void at the moment which can backfire negatively to the members of the public and the members of the medical schemes at the moment. It is after having a negotiated solution that we think this matter can be solved. Otherwise, one might have to warn Chairperson and say then the free market forces will be on rampage in filling in this gap. therefore making mockery of regulatory framework. These multilateral tariff negotiations are as comprehensive as we can. We are only leading this process, but people who are participating in it are multilateral, as the name suggests, but all-inclusive, which is more important. That means regulatory bodies, ourselves and HPCSA, we would have liked to have in the corner of the regulators, the one that regulates private private hospitals, which is not in place in N right now. We did mention in the last time that the existence or creation of a regulatory body for private hospitals is critical, given the trend that we have seen in now what happens when you're looking at the medical specialist course and the private hospitals. There is a need, and a dire need, and an urgent one, for the private hospitals to be regulated. That these multilateral negotiations would then, of course, include the healthcare funders themselves. They've all agreed to participate. They think this is important. To this end, the Director General and the Minister of Health will be meeting with us soon in order to work out issues that might be of Competition Commission concerns. Prescribed minimum benefits has been mentioned, and I think the head of the legal services has addressed that at length. It's important to note, just for the emphasis, that the PMBs are prescribed by law. PMBs are regulated by Regulation 8. 3, the PMBs are a critical, important pillar in a regulatory framework in the context of open enrollment and in dealing with the whole issue of risk, so that there is more community risking as opposed to financial risk. I'm not going to deal more about this. I think this has been mentioned. The aim of having these PMBs has been clearly articulated. The aim is to make sure that the emergencies, catastrophic medical conditions, and very expensive medical conditions are covered in each and every medical aid scheme, so that every individual, every citizen who has a medical scheme or any other form of healthcare insurance, for that matter, needs to be covered for these PMBs without co-payment or deductibles. There is a code of conduct that has been developed by the healthcare funders, by healthcare service providers, by the regulatory bodies, to which, in the interim, once there is an issue regarding the code of conduct of the PMBs which has not been finalized. My plea to the committee and to the, we've made this plea to the council, understands it very well, that the PMBs need to be in place and, in fact, expanded to cover all members of the public who join a medical aid scheme. If there's any challenge that comes against the Regulation 8 of the PMBs, it must be understood in this context. And this context is that they probably would be wanting to expose members, and then there would be deductibles, there would be co-payments if we take out the PMBs. And that is the position. In fact, that was the reason for introducing the PMBs in the Act and regulating them through Regulation 8. That ends the presentation that we have today. We would welcome the questions that come from the honorable members. We've got our website in there, which is out for the public to interrogate, and making sure that these, we are in contact, complaints are sent to us so that we can have this information with the aim of helping, assisting in promoting, coordinating the activities, both financial and non-financial, of the medical aid scheme, whilst at the same time we're protecting the public. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Danza. I'm not sure whether Chairperson wanted to say something. Probably you'll say it towards the end. Okay. You know, thank you very much. You know, there are certain things that are really pointing to the fact that you have got a clean audit, even if though we are not auditors, but some of the things that they're doing. You know, one of the things that really surprised us, we were with the Auditor General's office yesterday, and they informed us how important information is all about. And in fact, as policymakers, we are supposed to be guided by the information that we have. But what we notice is that most of the departments of health are not giving us the right information. And probably even themselves, they don't know that what information they have. And one of the things that are coming out here is that the information you have is just a question of making policies based on the information that you have. Hence, I'm not sure what members are going to say. Hence, we agree when we look at that information about who gets a lot of money, the private hospitals, the specialists. And the specialists, fortunately, they are being regulated by the HPSA, but the other one is not being regulated. Obviously, something needs to be done in that regard, if we are serious about what we are talking about. So I'm just saying that thank you very much for your presentation. We are going to engage on it now, but from my side, I think most of the things are very straightforward. But we will consider the things that you have mentioned. There are a few things that you have requested us specifically to look into as a committee, and we're definitely going to do. We're going to do that so that at the end we summarize what are we going to do, whether we agree or not, on helping you in those particular areas. Can we have a short tea, and then we come back and engage you on questions? If so, that's a short tea. Oh, Tadehana, Dumela, that. Welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, can we move towards our seats? Government themselves and they need to oversight what is being done with their money, because they're the ones who pay the tax. I don't think they know. It's just like the trustees who didn't know. They thought that the people who are supposed to do things are the administrators and whatnot. Yet, Dr. Gancho is answerable to them, because they are the ones who are popping out this money. I think if you can give us, what did you do to make the trustees understand, so that we can talk to this hospital board, the clinic committees, and make sure that they understand what's going on. Well, I don't have to make this one, but there's something that you notice, registered, that you are talking about regulating the hospital, private hospital industry. Probably something that is needed, but the most important thing that worries me is that you don't see a lot of primary health care that is going on there. Probably primary health care doesn't make a lot of money because those people are in business. But there's not a lot. As a result, we tend to think our health care system is very expensive. Yet, if we concentrated on primary health care, even then, probably it might not be expensive. Probably one thing that probably you can help us with your good information is to help us and understand how much does go to the general practitioners. Because we are at a primary health care level. I'm not talking about the specialists and the hospital, but the general practitioners themselves. And we always talk of shortage of personnel, doctors and nurses. Yet every small town that you go to, every small town will find that there's a GP there who's doing a lot of primary health care in that particular area, whether there's medical aid or no medical aid, but there's a GP there who is not regarded as part of the healthcare system by what we're doing now. And for me, that's primary healthcare, and we don't know how expensive it is for that person, whether he knows what he's doing or she knows what he's doing or he doesn't. But it's something that probably you could help us. Maybe I want to even ask our researchers to help us and find out how many GPs do we have in these small rural towns who are not part of the public health care system. They're running their own private practice. And how much does it cost those people who are going to them, whether they're paying from their pockets, but how much does it cost to run that service? Members, those are the questions that I'm sure even the board will answer some of the questions, especially that one of trustees. I've got my former teacher here, who should have been there when we were firing the deans. He should have been here. He's my former teacher. If I'm a useless doctor, then you must ask him, why am I a useless doctor? If I'm a good doctor, then you must say he did a good job. I'm not sure whether he's got a clean audit in his. I suspect he's got disclaimers. So Tebu, whether you are new or old, but you'll have to answer. And we might be asking the other Tebu, but the question is, won't know whether we're referring to you or the other Tebu. So members, let's we can have questions, and they are ready for us.
I see
Chairperson, thank you very much, and I really appreciate the report, but I would like to say it's the most complicated report. It's very complicated, but I don't know, is it the whom to say? You know, I understand why we get photocopies. It's because of cost containment. But you now, when there is bars and graphs, and there is keys there, and the keys are black, everything is black, and you have been given this report yesterday to go and read. When you get there, where you cannot deduce what the other black means, you get discouraged. I think I do understand why we do have that. As for the clean audit, I've learned within 2 days that I'm not going to congratulate anybody with unauthorized or clean audit, because the audit is another thing, and I always say that we as politicians, the clean audit is still for chartered accountants. Because I'm a politician, I want to see this clean audit coming together with a service delivery. What does this clean audit say to the service? That's what I want. Therefore, I'm very sorry, Chairperson, I'm not going to congratulate, because I did it on Tuesday and I regret it yesterday. And you know, when you do that, it is not healthy to your body, because on Tuesday I was overwhelmed. Yesterday I was disappointed. Now I'm supposed to be overwhelmed, but I'm in between. Now my body doesn't really take that. It cannot. But if you can tell me, with this clean audit, what does it say to service delivery? I will take it from there. Page 4. Is it page 4 or slide 4? 110 medical in at the end of 2009, it says that it's currently 105. Now, when the presentation was there, it was 103. I would like to know what happened. Then, do you know this? Even last year, the top 10 complaints. Page 6, I was having a problem around it. To be saying that unpaid account, you find that the medical aid doesn't pay the account for a reason. But I'm sitting there, I don't know I'm having any account, because I know that the account is taken over by a medical scheme. After some time, I get now, not from even my medical scheme. My medical scheme at a certain stage, it doesn't tell, I don't remember it telling me that it didn't pay because of 123. But I will just have an account. Sometimes I'm here, I don't go to my post office. I will even have the account being referred to the lawyer. And for me, when I joined my the medical aid, I was saying that let me pay on monthly basis somebody, so that somebody must take care of my account. And certain people are even blacklisted because of this. Can we I know that it is not you, but as a council, you are now platform to refer to really talk to. Then even the refusal by the scheme to issue authorization, you find that I'm critically ill, like I'm ill because of this the clean audit I've told you. When I go there, I don't even have money. Then I'm only being told while I'm at the counter that my medical aid cannot authorize. Now, where am I? I'm dying just on the doorstep of the train. I want to say, in a nutshell, the communication between the medical scheme and the members, it is very important. You know, the issue of the levies, I know what is it, but it sometimes baffles me, more especially when you go to pharmacy. While I'm in Rustenburg, I pay, because I'm a chronic patient, I pay a certain levy. But while I'm in Joburg and in Cape Town, I don't pay a levy for the same chronic medication. I know that I will be told that Rustenburg is very far from the people. But when I look at the life of the people around there, they are the poor of the poorest, and they are the people who are paying a lot of levies. Can we just do this? consumer education, page my head. I've been in most, I think, three different medical aid. I don't remember, or am I not a consumer, being educated. I just join because I have to. At a certain stage, even government, the department said, because you are a government employee, no more GEMS, now permit. No more bonitas, now GEMS. But I haven't seen this. Yes, they will be there when you start for advertising themselves. Thereafter, also about for the rest of your life, you just say you become frustrated. Now, you are saying that there is consumer education. I'm trying to rattle through chapter 7, I'm sorry. Okay, then 39. Okay. This one I was saying that you, this imposition, where certain medical schemes are being imposed. Like we were in, I was in Platinum Health, then when GEMS came, we were told that everybody, irrespective that I was comfortable where I was, but I was supposed to leave my medical aid. When I came to Parliament, I was in GEMS, I adapted with GEMS. Now it says permit. Why should I not be allowed to choose while I'm in the public service? Then the last thing. When the culture, there is this culture that medical aid works mostly in private hospitals, not in public hospital. And why it is like that, I cannot go to public hospital because of the state of the hospital. And we always run to the private hospital. Like I'm a public representative. I'm just like this woman who cook supper for the family. After she has cooked, to get out and eat somewhere. I don't know if you understand what I'm talking about. I'm in the public arena, but because of the standard, the standard of medical aid in the public sector, I cannot take my permit and go to Josephman Hospital because of its state. I go to Fencast Hospital. What is the council doing to help to put the private and public in par so that the medical aid can the revenue from the medical aid can help even the public facility to grow? Because my take is the private hospital are good as they are, and they are delivering the service because they do have revenue. The public, they don't, they depend on what they get from the hospital. The revenues are not correct. Thank you, Chairperson.
So you'll be answering, but maybe let me protect you in some of the things. One, about the documents, the color, it's not them.
Yeah.
It's actually, we should blame Move Your Guys and the team, not Gunda.
Yeah.
Because they don't have a machine that prints out the colors. So I think you don't have to answer that one. So we'll try and sort it out in Parliament.
Yeah.
I know there's a very thin line between the Council of Medical Aid Schemes as a regulator and the medical aid themselves. So you might find that some of the questions that are going to be posed to you are going to be medical aid. And I would suspect that probably if you don't want to delve into that particular area, you don't have to, because it is not what it is not your mandate. But if you want to, because most of the things that have been said here, maybe let me go into this one of medical aid and the use of which hospital. I think the onus is on us as public representatives to go to our public institutions, or to go to wherever, but mainly public institutions, because that's where it's up to us. So that when we come back, I can tell people that the service in that hospital is so bad, up to bad. Not to talk about people that something that they have not tested. But I know from experience, you know, there's one thing that has been mentioned in the 10-point plan, which talks about leadership, improving leadership and improving management. It was because there's something that was picked up, that in our institutions, the public institutions, they are very lax in charging medical aid. I know from experience. I went to my son went to Port Elizabeth Hospital in Livingston, which is a public institution. And when he was there, one of the top administrators told him that, look, oh, you've got a medical aid. Yeah, he said yes. They said, no, go to a private hospital. If you've got a medical aid, don't come here. An administrator of the hospital. So this is why there's been a decision that we need to look at the management of those institutions, because they are not collecting revenue from the medical aid deliberately. And it is not you, the regulator. I think it's something that we need to work on with the department. That they must, if I go to those hospitals, I must be able to be charged on my medical aid. But there's another challenge. I don't know in national, but if you collect revenue in these institutions, that revenue that gets collected, there's no incentive for the Department of Health. That revenue goes to National Treasury, and they disperse it the way they do. Now, it doesn't make the hospitals or the Departments of Health to be interested in collecting the revenue, because you're going to collect this revenue. When you get all these billions, they go somewhere else. Yet, they should be creating an incentive that if you collect more, we'll give you so that you can handle your hospital. And the hospital is left in a dilapidated state, and the money goes somewhere else where you don't even know. So I think these are some of the challenges. And those challenges are for the parliamentarians to discuss them. But you can go into the other blacklisting. Maybe you can tell us on the blacklisting. But I'm requesting members so that we must understand this thin line between the regulator and the medical aid. Because at some stage, we need to call this medical aid scheme and hit them very hard. Okay, Mike.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Chair, have you been reading DA policy? Not giving out some sort of incentives. I think you have. If I can just ask a few questions. We did have a Council for Medical Schemes here a few weeks ago, so it seems very difficult to ask. You know, I'm not going to repeat the questions that I asked then, but I do feel I'm obliged to ask you something to justify you coming down to Cape Town. But yeah, on slide 6, the number of complaints. Now, I've added them up, and obviously one complaint is one too many. Don't get me wrong. But the fact is, if you add the top 10 up, I get 4,092. Now, if you take that as a percentage of the number of beneficiaries in the private sector, of 8.1 million, it turns out that 0.05% complaints, as opposed to the number of beneficiaries, which seems quite small, right? I mean, it does. So I just want to get clear in my mind. Is it small because of the efficiencies of the medical aid schemes? Or is it because maybe a lot of the consumers don't know where to send the complaints to? Now, if you look at on slide 10, you talk about consumer education and you spend 1% on consumer education. Now, I don't know if that's high or low. To me, it seems a bit low. I don't know what the general norm is, but But to me, if people don't know that you exist, and I don't think many, most members on private medical aids know you exist, you know, they wouldn't know where to go to. And for example, you know, medical aid schemes like Discovery, not our medical aid scheme, PalMed, we don't receive any weekly, monthly magazine or anything like that, but Discovery does send out a regular magazine, I believe, and I'm sure others do as well. I'm not punting Discovery, please. But, I mean, do they give you opportunities within that magazine to promote yourself and to make their members aware that you exist and who to, you know, where they should contact you? Or do you yourself place ads in those magazines? Just to give us some indication of how you actually do consumer education. Then, on the administration costs, I think it's page slide 31, where it says 7.5 billion was spent on administration. I mean, do you do any survey to ensure how effective the administration is? I mean, are members getting value for money? I mean, are claims being processed within a, you know, set time frame, for example? And if one compares 8.1 million members to unpaid accounts of 1,286, then the answer seems to be resounding yes. But I mean, that does, you know, but it's not necessarily so. So I just want to know if you actually gauge the effectiveness of the administration of the Medicaid schemes. And then lastly, just on GEMS, I mean, it was said that obviously it's a new scheme. It doesn't have the 25% solvency. What period have you given them? When does that period, you said they've got this grace period. When does that end? If you can just give us some indication. Thank you very much, Chair.
I've even forgotten the hands that that are the all. Oh, it is very much. I think the other one, Mr. Kale, there's something that you are asking, but I'll answer it before they answer themselves. I'll let them talk about it. Okay, remember.
Okay, thank you, Sean. Thank you very much for a good presentation. Oh, is that okay. Congratulations on your clean audit, both financially and in terms of your performance. Because for me, when you say you passed the AG test in terms of performance information report, so you've been giving two reports instead of one, the financial one that we know. So definitely congratulations. And, you know, if service delivery was a big pie, you would be one third of that pie. So if every other part doesn't play its role, one third of the pie cannot give, you know, a good service delivery to the whole thing. So congratulations. Do not despair. Continue. The other, I'm not sure after one third, what is left, one seventh or whatever, will come around and eventually will have service delivery. Basically, on the same page, that talks to the top 10 complaints. You said this helps you to gauge your performance and, you know, how you improve services. I just want to know, especially on the unpaid account, the refusal by the scheme to issue authorization, the administrative inefficiencies, and unauthorized deductions. Do you have any other plans, you know, to address this? What is it that you're going to do as a mother body or the regulator to address this? Especially unauthorized deductions. If you can explain that, what is it fraud or, you know, just explain it so that you understand it. Because, I mean, like it has already been alluded that you spend 1% on your consumer education and the other 1% on your trustee training. So why do we still have, you know, those, especially the unpaid accounts and unauthorized? It's a little confusing. And then on page 15 or slide 15, I just want to ask, in 2008 you had 114, 2009 1110, 2010 105, recently plus minus 103, so it's plus minus 11. Medical aid schemes that has fallen down or whatever. I just want to inquire, are those open or restricted? And
either or, are those medical aid schemes that we don't have, the ones that, you know, don't have that medical background that we've spoken to, and, you know, have you assessed actually what type of medical aid schemes are those? I mean, were they after money and not, you know, service in terms of members? And besides that, voluntary, what did you say, voluntary liquidation that they asked for, but just for us to have a clear background, were they open ones or restricted ones? Thank you very much.
Okay, Malthul is going to be the last one. You'll be the last one. I think it's because I'm still on the side. Members, I think congratulations, we're not going to meet the Auditor General after that. So I think they've got a clean audit, and it will remain a clean audit.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. excuse me, I want to go to page 4 on this voluntary liquidation of the scheme. What does it actually mean? I'm asking because, you know, I was in private practice at the time, and what one found there is that schemes, doctors make claims, you know, they send their claims, and then they're not paid. 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, they're not paid. And then the next thing which comes up is that the scheme is gone. It's no longer there. And that's it, you know. And what seemed to be the case was that after a while, in fact, they re-emerge, these schemes which were supposed to have gone somewhere. After a while, they come back again. So I just think that there's something going on there. Now, the other thing which I would like to point out is the delays that practitioners suffer in getting their claims processed. Very, very serious indeed, because it makes, cash flow. Cash flow, the chair did say that private doctors, GPs, are actually primary health care. It is like that, yes. Now, you find that the claims are not paid and creep in of irregularity there about keeping the doctors well paid for the claims so that they don't experience problems of cash flow to run the business. And this is really a serious handicap to the GPs out there. And in fact, let's describe some of these things, the GPs. They describe them really as they feel abused by medical aid schemes. And I must say that it has resulted in a number of doctors leaving private practice altogether. And the problem is medical aid schemes, the way they handle business when it comes to general practitioners. Now, the other thing is this one of pay, you know, members. Somebody alluded to it, I think. Members suddenly finding that when they go for, they require medical treatment and all that, and then they discover there and then that after a phone call has been made, and then the medical aid scheme says that the money is exhausted. And this happens, it could happen in August. It can happen, you know, at a time of the year when it's difficult to understand. But the financial year isn't even two-thirds of the way gone. And what are these people supposed to do? Where is there, why is that better managed then, you know, than this? Because really patients do suffer.
And then I also want to, you know, to talk to this thing of levies when we, you know, we who are on chronic medication go to get a supply of chronic, medication. Why are levies there at all? I don't understand. And, you know, they can be pretty high. Pretty high, you know. It just seems to undo the fact that this elderly person has bought a medical aid. We should be paying for this chronic medication. And then when you go, if you haven't got money because the levies are so high, it means you can't go. You can't. Sometimes you say, I can't go because I don't have the money. I mean, people have said this. I can't go because I don't have the money for this levy. And then they'll go without a treatment. So I would just like that looked into why it should be like that. Now, you mentioned as you were presenting with the fellow, there's no relation between members' fees. Something maybe I didn't understand you or the studio. No relation between members and fees paid to brokers. Something like that. Now, I think we've looked into this matter of brokers before, as the committee said. What are brokers there for in the first place? You know, the cost, they are employed. It's work for them, you know, they get employment. But that cost is passed on to the members. And what is in it for the members? For the stretch of imagination, I can't see why they are there, you know, except we want to give perhaps some people employment, I don't know. But it's at the expense of the members who really are poor people. They can't afford all these things that we're talking about. And I think I'll stop there just now.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is actually a question, more a comment. I would like to start in congratulating you. Because as I know, student unqualified for the report. Student is not dirty. So, congratulations. And also, I would like to congratulate you on your the strategic objectives you set yourself. I've been reading through it, and as a former teacher, I give you 90%. So, 10% so outstanding, not done, not well done. Considering all those issues you didn't achieve. And then I would like to go to the Risk Equalization Fund. I've been reading through that also, there's a lot there. But things like the legal framework support the Department of Health and finalizing amendments to the medical scheme is not done. Form orders on REF data not done. So there's a more or less a 50% success rate. So I do believe that the department, they must concentrate on that issue also the coming year. Thank you, sir.
You want to add something? Let's give you 30 seconds.
This is just a tease, I think. But, you know, in the old days, private doctors were paid a particular fee, you know, which was an extremely reasonable fee. And I think even now, you know, that's still the case. Then, there's a package. It's a package of everything. And then the doctors charge 80 rand, 90 rand, or whatever. something like that. Now, we have this, which just for consultation alone, consultation, it's already more than the package fee, you know, that was paid before. And when it comes to, you know, the stratification of medication and charging per item and all that and all that, it's huge. And my own feeling when I came upon this and saw this happening, I thought, but it means that now medical care is actually has moved into an expensive field rather than, you know, being affordable, you know, for the ordinary people. I would like your comment on this one.
Thank you, Master. That was the last one.
I don't think we need another 10. But I think as you are listening to the question, we are elected members by our communities. They elected us to be here. But as Honorable Mr. Khaled Defai said, she said it was a good presentation, but it's confusing. There's a lot of information. And I think she's right. I don't think, for others, this is very simple. But the only thing that we seem not to understand is how medical aids work. Maybe, I'm raising this, because we are elected by people and we are representing them here. If there are certain things that we don't know, then we are failing them. So I'm just requesting, as a neutral body, neutral regulator, you are not medical aid yourself, you are neutral, and you can tell us honestly, not now, some other time, not really a training or a workshop, but just to tell us how medical aids work. What are they there for? So that we can even advise each other whether GEMS is better than PAMET is better than Discovery, because we don't know as of now. And we can't even advise people. People are going to come to us and say, you are in the health portfolio community, what is the situation? But you need to find time. I'm really asking you, register, to help us at some stage, not today. And you won't be coming to, you'll be giving an update. I know the Minister of Education wants to remove that B. The adult basic, it must not be basic, it must be adult education. So you need to give us that adult education on a particular day. You come and give us that adult education on medical aid, because we are doing this because we are neutral men. Whereas other medical, if we call Discovery, he'll be swaying us to join them. If you bonnet us, he'll be swaying us to join them. We don't want somebody who's going to influence us. We want somebody who's going to tell us honestly that this is what, but it's not for today. But you can answer the other questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks, honorable members of the committee, for your questions. And also thank you for the qualified congratulations on by some of you on our AR. Thank you for that. I take the challenge of doing the education and training on the medical aid schemes at some stage, as you have indicated, Chairperson. I think it is useful from any regulator that is neutral in dealing with these aspects. Except to say that information is power. Information is very important for the consumers or for people to make a choice as to which medical aid scheme of the 105 medical schemes that we now have, so that an individual does not choose the 104th medical aid scheme that I said it might actually be under liquidation or curated in the next few days or even weeks. I think it's very important. The only thing I can say with regard to that, and maybe the chairperson will give an input at a later stage regarding that, is whenever a medical aid scheme is presented to any individual, information must be available at that point of service.
we're saying as moving on forward in the rest of the world wants a situation, a civilized world at least, to be in a situation where at the point of service there is no question of being asked, have you got money at that point in time to treat your heart attack, to treat your stroke, to treat your pneumonia. Because if then the answer is to the negative at that point in time, it means you're not going to access that service. That is a broad principle that should deal with this. And the PM, the prescribed minimum benefits, and our regulation aid in the medical aid schemes attempts to do that. The 270 conditions that are stipulated under PMVs and the 2025 CDLs, chronic disease list that is present there, and all emergencies is an attempt to make sure that at least with these conditions that may be catastrophic in nature, one, two, that may be very expensive and beyond the affordability of any individual, must not be subjected to deductibles and co-payments. So that is an attempt to do that. It's clearly not adequate because the other, I said 270 conditions. What about then the other conditions that are beyond the 270? It means then they are subjected to the co-payments and deductibles. That's the challenge that is faced by each and every one of us. And that's what let me say that is in premise the response to the question. I'm going to deal with some of the questions, as I mentioned. My colleagues will help me in that regard and deal with some of them that I might not deal with in detail. But the question...
Some of them, you can pull them
across the sea. You have answered the question of the color printer, and we thank you for that. We sent an electronic version to the committee, which was in color. The second one is on the clean audit. What does it mean to service delivery? And I think this is an important question because these clean audits that we have are enjoying and are basking in the sun of it at the moment, eventually it must talk to the mandate that we are having, which is to control, coordinate, supervise the activities of the medical aid schemes in all its forms, in the financial and non-financial. What it then would mean is that the members of the public out there and 8.1 million lives that are covered need to get the best service. They need to have access to health care. And we are to make sure that is done by all the 105 medical aid schemes that we are having. It must also mean that any other person who is not covered by any medical scheme at the moment must, when that person makes a choice to join a health care fund or to fund for conditions, medical condition or health condition that might have, that person is in a safe environment, is working in a safe environment. We have got tools in place, Jefferson, to make sure in the form of monitoring the super financial aspects of the sustainability of this game, so that there are no fly-by-night that come in and claim that they can fund your health care moving forward. We make sure that we do not register them, those medical aid schemes. We do not accredit them, we do not give them accreditation. The managed healthcare organizations that come in as some subsets of the schemes do not get into the market and come and confuse or mislead the market, as they call it, the public, as we call it, and the beneficiaries. We've got tools in place that are audited and they have passed this test that we do that. The other units that we have within the office would be benefits management units, which would look at the rules that the schemes would submit and say they are going to administer their schemes according to these specific rules. When they design these rules and they are convinced that these are the correct rules for a specific medical scheme of the 105, they must submit those rules to our office, to the council. Then the council adjudicates over them, amends them, change them, reject them even. We do that and we've got tools to do so, so that what is out there in the public domain would have gone through this rigorous process. We think that that would talk a lot to the service delivery, but again, I am saying specifically to the 8.1 million lives and the members of the public that have got the potential to be covered by this scheme. It is then up to the broad policy making issues that would say that 8.1 million lives is not enough. We've got 50 million people in the country. What about the other 48, 42 million? That is, the information you're giving is meant to inform
you in making a decision at a political policy level. Our duty is to implement the law, is to stick to the mandate. Section 7 of the medical aid schemes gives us that mandate and an authority to do so. It goes further, they say we must and we should advise the minister, and can be conferred certain other duties upon us to deal with any other matter that relates to private health care. So that's the kind of service delivery we're trying to operate within in that scope. The number of medical schemes that has dropped from 110 to 105, variety of reasons my colleagues have explained that some of the schemes are now merging and consolidating. There's anxiety out there taking place with the medical schemes as to what their future will be, and this question has come up in many ways, that the 110 to 105 or even less numbers that we're going to have of the schemes themselves does not relate to the number of the beneficiaries covered per se. It has been shown that the number of the schemes is coming down, but the number of the lives covered has in fact over the past 1 year went up from 7 million to 8.1 million. We've always heard that there's 7 million people covered by the schemes, or lives covered 7 million for the past number of about 6-7 years. Now we're having 8.1. The point I'm making is that it is not necessarily the case that the decrease in number of schemes relates to the decrease in the number of lives covered. In fact, there is an increase. And that, the reasons might be to a very large extent to the consolidate, the amalgamate, the increasing the economies of scale. Some of them obviously get go under curatorship and liquidation. Some have gone under liquidation, and some will continue to go under liquidation. We'll make that decision with the council when we have to do so in order to protect the medical aid schemes, because there is no point having a medical aid scheme that is out there claiming that it can cover any kind of an emergency, any kind of ailments for medicine. When that happens, the number is left hanging. We then have to take prudent steps to liquidate such schemes as a last resort. We help and assist them in the process that would lead to liquidation. Obviously, it is the worst thing that can happen, because when a liquidation of a medical scheme takes place, somebody gets hurt. And somebody gets hurt at a very difficult time when you have got a hospital bill that can run into hundreds of thousands of rand. And therefore, we must make sure that we cover those beneficiaries and we find a home for them. We have to many instances speak to some schemes to accommodate people like that. So we do not take that decision very lightly. The top 10 complaints that we have, a lot of questions relate to the complaints that we have. I'm happy that this comes up as a complaint. Why these complaints? Because it's a way that we try and engage, as I've mentioned in earlier on, so that eventually this might lead to a name and shame situation. A name and shame situation where we have to rate the medical aid schemes on the basis of these complaints, blacklist them even. We have not done that yet. We have only now even improved the capacity in that unit that deals with the complaints, so that we can address and be responsive to the complaints that come up. It's one of our strategic objectives that we must satisfy the public and members of the medical aid schemes whenever they have got a complaint or under stress and duress. We communicate this, and we encourage medical aid schemes to communicate this to the members as members are joining in at that point in time. Many of them do not communicate this information. And one can assume, therefore, and can only assume the reasons for them not communicating and disclosing all this information to people as they apply to become members of the schemes. It's not far-fetched to say that it's probably not in the interest of a scheme to communicate all information, because if they communicate all information, they might consider themselves to be out of business, because it would mean there will be more people claiming and so on. But the strategic objective number two of the Council for Medical Schemes is very clear on dealing with this. It says we need to assist and disseminate the information out there for people to be informed about the medical aid scheme, what it stands for, what are people entitled to, what they are not entitled to, within the rules that we would have set for ourselves, and the same rules that we would have set for the schemes in themselves. So the education and training unit of the Council for Medical Aid Schemes does spend a considerable amount of money with regard to that. I accept that the amount of money we are spending in that field is probably not enough. it will never be enough for us to do so, to educate everybody out there. And that is why even the levies that we have levied, the increase in levies that some of the schemes have complained about, that it's too much, it is in the region of a double digit, we have to make sure that we cover and we do not compromise on educating and training them as much as well as in protecting them legally as we do. So that bill will always continue up. We've got the best people within the council to do this work. The council has over the years established and had an ethos of making sure that the people that we have within the council are properly trained, they are properly skilled, they are properly qualified, and to deal with these aspects. So the percentage that we spend in various aspects of our strategic objectives will always differ, and our aim is to improve on that in preparation for many more other bigger challenges that are coming within us. So the issue of the co-payment differentiation, as it has been mentioned, between towns, cities, and rural areas, I think that is an important question, and because it would be wrong if one person belonging to one medical aid scheme in one place is not paying any co-payment or there's no deductibles, but when he moves, or he or she moves to another place in the form of a city or a town, and then there is a difference. I would imagine, maybe my colleagues will add on to this one, that probably people staying in Johannesburg and staying in some rural area in Mbangi, you know, Kunu or somewhere else, would probably, the pharmacy out there would be asking for a different comment. It should not be like that. In fact, like I mentioned in earlier on, we're striving and want a situation that there is no co-payment at all, wherever one is. That is what we're aiming for, and that is what we're striving for, and that's what we have to inform, and we're informing the medical aid scheme with regards to the issue of differential and co-payment or deductible. I've touched on the question of consumer education, as it has been mentioned, as well as GEMS, adverts, and brokers, and I think this issue of GEMS, PAMED, or any other schemes, the rules that they would have designed and submitted to us are the rules that would, like I mentioned, we interrogate rigorously. And on brokers, the slide shows that it's telling on its own. Why do we need brokers? Do we need them at all? The answer is, I see Dr. Lutuli is immediately saying, no, we do not need them. When I put the question to them, they say that we will be robbing them of 1.1 billion rand. That money we can use it, as you can see, we can use it for all sorts of things, I mean, outside of that brokerage. The only thing I can say, that, Chair, is that the Department of Labor has addressed the question of labor and labor, need for labor, pretty decisively. Then the question would be, has the Department of Finance and the Ministry of Health dealt with it as decisively as the Labour Department of Labour has, and that answer absolutely lies outside of my authority as the Council for Medical Skills, but it does serve as a homework for yourselves to deal with them. My duty is to show you what it costs, what it means. The costs are increasing. The objective of getting them, more of the members coming in, is clearly not talking to each other. I think your decision will be made easily. The question of the schemes versus use of the schemes, the state facilities claiming from the medical aid schemes versus the private hospitals claiming the facilities, I think you have addressed that. Chairperson, that the administrative systems within the public healthcare sector are currently not in place. In many of the interactions that we're having with the industry, we are pointing out the medical schemes in the first place that they must pay public hospitals when they claim for them. There's one complication, though. It's not a major complication. The billing system of the public hospitals differs slightly from that of the private hospital. They call it PF. I think that is the billing system that the public hospitals do, as opposed to in the private healthcare sector, they bill, private hospitals bill as they wish, private doctors bill as they wish. So even the public hospital is trying to address this issue of the billing system. Maybe that system, PFSA, I think it is called PFSA, that they are using in the public hospitals would have to change. That's one. The other questions that were raised talk to Discovery Health, its newsletters, or any other medical aid schemes with regard to education and training. Let me put it this way. Discovery Health or any other medical aid scheme, we regulate them. We do not collude with them. We do not treat them in any way, favor the bully in any way. We actually not for to our name as the Council for Medical Schemes, in order to protect the public, cannot be overtly associated with any medical aid scheme or administrator that we regulate. We when they advertise sometimes even something good for the industry, when we look at it is good, we do not endorse it. We just look at it in terms of the rules that they are having and the rules that they submitted to us and in our rules, and if it is correct, we say that is fine. If it is wrong, it is in contravention of any of the rules that we have and that they are having, that they have registered with us, we come up and we in fact point it out that it is wrong, it must be withdrawn. We advise on what is the correct information that should go out into the public in any way, so that we do not see the name of the medical aid schemes co-branding with any of the entities that we regulate. That is in broad strokes and in principle we're operating in from that environment. We do acknowledge that some of the good work is done by them in advancing the cause of the Council for Medical Schemes and the mandate, and we congratulate them for that, because they are, to us, they are doing what they are supposed to be doing. The issue of the non-healthcare expenditure and schemes administration, when it comes to the schemes, the efficiencies, I think the NHE, non-healthcare costs or non-healthcare expenditures, is an issue that when we delineate and find out which areas are there, we just mentioned now the brokers is one area. Obviously, the other area is administration costs, and that is where most of the costs go to. We're monitoring that on a regular basis in management accounts that are submitted to the relevant units within the council. The GEMS and the grace period, the question was about GEMS when it came in 2005, 2006. Prior to that, there was no GEMS. They had a period of them to raise their reserves to reach the solvency level of 25%. The statute does stipulate from the time of registration of a medical scheme up to a time when they must reach 25% solvency. That time is they have now reached it as it is. And as soon as then they did that, it clearly had certain implications in the market with regard to restricted and non-restricted medical aid scheme. We're not mentioning GEMS in here because we like it or we do not like it. We're very neutral about it. What we do, we observe what trends and what impacts does this have in moving forward. The issue of the top 10 complaints, I think those each and every one are important. One complaint is too important and good for us to note than any one of those. The percentage I mentioned earlier on, that the percentage that we are spending on addressing that as a percentage of our expenditure is still not adequate. It's one of the growing areas of our work and our operations to address these complaints, because if we do not address these complaints, we will then, our credibility as a regulator, statutory regulator at that, would be at stake. In fact, we've gone further in dealing with this issue of the complaints by introducing the hotline of fraud in the website of the Council for Medical Schemes. We're finalizing the establishment of that so that all kinds of complaints and any kind of reporting that would relate to fraud and corruption are dealt with by an independent body, which unfortunately we have to pay for it. We have to pay it for good reasons. And therefore, when the levies for the medical aid schemes have to go up, it is also meant to finance such operations. They are very important. I think those complaints, each and every one, I can give each one individually, the one that is mentioned, unauthorized deductions. There should not be any unauthorized deduction or any scheme or any pre-authorization that is denied, whilst in fact the person should be pre-authorized to access a certain healthcare service. If anybody, and we make this information available in the public, that any of the complaints that might be there and that relate to the medical scheme must be presented to us. That is why our website, our call center, faxes and telephones are, in certain instances, pretty jammed when there are issues that come into welcome with what those facilities. We keep on improving on them. Voluntary liquidation of schemes. What is this? Voluntary liquidation of schemes when the schemes and administrators, managed care organizations and healthcare brokers feel at some stage that their financial situation is so bad that they cannot continue in business, they do apply for liquidation voluntarily, and they have to notify us. We need to know why they are going into liquidation. They sit with us. We would have monitored them closely with a system called ICU, like intensive care unit, which monitors each and every one of them closer to the time, so that when they go liquidation, or when we go the route of liquidating them, we would have known beforehand what would have left to that. Any remedial actions would have been considered for that not to happen, or to happen depending what the case may be. We think that this issue of the liquidation, like I said, is really the last step, which we do not take lightly, but in the protection of the interests of the scheme, we have to do that. We've got to do what we have to do at times. The re-emergence of them, when they re-emerge at some stage, somewhere in one form or the other, I guess it is the issue of them using various commercial tools and entities for them to do so. Company PTY, company ABC coming up again as company XYZ is an issue. What we have to look at are the people behind and driving that. I'll give an example. When the board of trustees members are put into section, I think it is section 46, which would deal with the members of the board of trustees, them not to continue. We want to track them that they do not reappear somewhere else. We do everything we possibly can at the time when we are deregistering that, or not deregistering, when we do not recognize that board of trustees of that medical aid schemes, including the individuals and personalities in it, so they do not reemerge in some, because it will be the same people, probably with the same tendencies and behavior that would come in another. So we're looking into that. The issue that I wanted to deal with is, again, when it comes into financial monitoring, is a matter of the real-time monitoring. Real-time monitoring is not an easy process, but we're committed to it. We think it is a good thing to monitor these schemes on a real-time basis, like you do when you're monitoring your companies in Johannesburg Stock Exchange, in JSE. Those technologies are in place to monitor them as they're performing, so people can make decisions at that point in time when to buy or sell shares. More or less the same thing. Actually, it would be easier, in my assessment, when we implement a real-time monitoring within the medical aid schemes. Only few of them, 105, number is decreasing. We have fewer. How many companies do we have in the stock exchange? And it's done on a real basis. We've gone for 105. This is something that can be done. We think we'll be able to do and pick up things much earlier than it is in right now. Brokers, a delicate question of the brokers. Capitation, doctors will be paid a particular fee at some stage. Yes, it is true, Dr. Lutuli, that doctors will be paid a certain fee at that time. That was then. And now they are telling us, doctors themselves and many of the service providers, that the cost and ROI, return on investment, is this and that, and therefore the issue of being paid by given a beast or a chicken or an ox, I think they are gone those days. It used to happen, I remember. This is now not the issue, but then other things have now become, they've come into place now to make sure that they collude the service providers now. They sit together and set out a price. They sit with the medical aid schemes and come up with various kinds of forms. They would sit as a big association. When that association is attacked for collusion, SAMA, for instance, was attacked for collusion, was penalized by Competition Commission, 1 million rand, together with HASA and BHF, you recall those days. That then stopped after the penalization. Who knows that they now sit as a small group of only pediatricians, a small group of only gynecologists, obstetricians, and surgeons, and they do the same thing, but now on a much smaller scale. We have to point out these as we meet with the minister on a regular basis and inform them that the landscape is changing. It has changed to this extent. This has now re-emerged in a different form. Watch out for it so that the Competition Commission laws can also address the issue of collusion. That is why we then have this multilateral negotiation process with all the stakeholders to find out, now that there is no RPL on the table, how do we deal, excuse me, how do we then deal with the void that is left out there in coming in dealing with the issues of costs and the cost, healthcare costs that we all know they are going up. Most, I'm happy to say that most of the stakeholders are in agreement with this. Most of the stakeholders are participating in the process of coming in up with a negotiated price tariff with the guidance, of course, that should come from the Competition Commission and the Department of Health and the Minister. Many of them are part of that, except for, as I reported last time, one grouping, which is the grouping constituting private hospitals. Private hospitals are very reluctant to participate in this process, and we would have liked them to become part of it, given the trends that were shown in here by my colleagues regarding the private hospital costs that are driving the whole of it to the roof. Now, that needs to be addressed. The communication that we are sending out is that we will continue getting and engaging the stakeholders with or without the private hospital groups. That is why it's becoming more important and urgent on the part of the minister and the healthcare portfolio in terms of the legislative framework to look into the private healthcare, private hospitals, in with regard to finding a way of trying and bringing them to, bringing them into line. Whether that is regulation or not, that's a matter that, from our point of view, we think it would be able to help, because all other stakeholders that are in this process are being regulated. The last question talked about the command strategic objectives, 90% pass rate I'm referring to, that were given by... That's right. Thank you, Chief Whip. Thanks for that. We'll stick to all our strategic objectives as they are right now. They talk to the core of our mandate, and we will improve. And I promise that by the time we meet Sinan again next year, we will have moved from 90% pass to 100% pass. I think that is our aim. And I have talked about the risk equalization fund. We will talk about this with our politically, and we'll watch and how the process moves going in into the national health insurance. When, at what point do we think the data that we'll be having with regard to RAF will be useful to the NHI as it is being implemented, or even dump it if it is not working? We've always said, and this is our view. I'll leave it to my colleagues. Maybe they have covered a couple of few things. There are things that I have not covered thoroughly, and I'll give them an opportunity to do so. Thank you.
Why do I think that probably we don't really need to go that route? I'm asking the members. Maybe all we need to do is just to ask the chairperson to close that, and then we call it a request.
So thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you to the staff of the council. Thank you to honourable members for listening to us. My comments can be very, very brief, but I want to appeal to the Parliamentary Petroleum Committee on Health to assist us to amend the legislation. As you would have seen, all of the complaints that you raise reflect the fact that our legislative framework is not adequate. We need your help. We are boxing in this match against a heavyweight, and we are lightweight with our hands tied behind our backs as a regulator. We really need to have the legislative power to regulate more efficiently and more effectively. And on that note, I want to just thank you very much for being here. I hope you apply your minds to our best to amend the legislation along the lines that the staff will present to you, hopefully through the Ministry of Health. We do need you to help us with that process. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. As you can see, I hope Uden wanted to say something, but then we apologize. I see Vunupebuho and Craig wanted to say something, but we apologize. It only means that you have done good work. So we're not keeping quiet because you have done bad work, you have done good work. Even Abu Muresi were skeptical about congratulations. I think now they are saying that you must be congratulated. Even after this answering of questions, you have done good work. So we really congratulate you. Chairperson, on this, your team that you're leading really gives us hope. In some of that, I was listening this morning, I'm not sure whether you saw it, they were talking about ANC in Gauteng, that when they go to the election, they'll try and look for capacity when they put people on the list. And I think this is, as we're sitting here, we're listening to you, and we're asking ourselves, why don't we deploy some of these people? Maybe you'll help us. Why don't we deploy some of these people in certain key positions in some of these departments of health? Maybe we'll talk about that some other time. I'm not trying to recruit Mike. I'm not trying to recruit him to come to this. But you know, you've really done good work. No, but recruit him to ANC. He's coming to ANC. No, he's already got his two friends. I'm trying to recruit Mike. I'm not going to stop. I'll only stop recruiting him when I leave Parliament. I'm going to continue recruiting you.
And we love to work in halftime.
You know, but we're just saying that was good work. Chairperson, on the amendment, you know, we talked about inequities and inequalities that are not caused by the present administration that we found ourselves in. And there are certain suggestions that maybe to address these inequalities, this is what we need to do. This is what, and one hopes that there will come something that is going to be able. On these amendments, while we are trying to look at the situation, how do we address these inequalities, I think probably these amendments that we are talking about should actually inform us as to where do we want to go 10 years, 20 years. So probably this is what we need to do. We need to sit down and look at these amendments that we want to do and look at what we want to, where we want to be in so many years, and then try and fit them in so that we can. But there's no doubt about it that, as somebody said yesterday, that was the Auditor General, who said, if you are given small money and you are not able to use it, but you want more, it's difficult to give that person. But the way that you have done, and one of the things that is worrying in a regulator, is that they must not abuse the powers that have been given to them. And listening to what you have told us, there's no suggestion that you have abused your powers. Then it makes it easy for us to think of giving you more powers to do this thing. But in giving those more powers to you, we need to look at what is our vision in 20 years, where do we want to be, so that when we craft those powers, we must do it looking at that particular vision that we're looking at. And this is what I would suggest that we do later. That's why I said probably we need to sit down with the legal team from the Council of Medical Education and see and put it with what we want to do, because that's the end of the day. Where do we want? Maybe in those 20 years I'll be dead, but we're doing it for South Africans so that when we die, they don't. I remember one time I read an article. Somebody was saying who B.J. Foster, they're trying to, who Steve Biko is trying to wake up B.J. Foster and ask him why did he do this. We don't want to be woken up when you are dead or in the grave. We want to go to the grave having done what is good for South Africans, and that will be the end of it. So thank you very much. I think your money was well spent coming down here. And we've got the answers. And as you can see, the whole committee, I'm just looking at them. I see all of them are happy with what you're doing. So continue with your good work. No, we won't chase them away. We won't chase them away. And this year, I can only say that maybe that's good work of Professor Glenn Thompson, because even the register was taught by him. I'm not sure whether I was teaching him to deliver babies or whatever, but whatever you were teaching him, Prof. GT, but he's done, he's doing well, wherever he is. So thank you very much. Keep your good work. We are hoping that you could impact or infect other people with the good work that you're doing. The only thing that you don't need to infect them with is that the last time you had few females, but now you've actually dropped. There's only one now. On the board, there's not even one female. The only thing that we are sharing is the name table for that. So you need that balance. I think from the board, down to the administration. There needs to be that balance, that control balance. Thank you very much. So we requested the members just to remain for 5 minutes. The members, so because they are not elected members, so you can leave. Okay, members, we're going to be very short. It's about what we discussed yesterday. We've looked at everything. We noticed that there's no way that we can't have a meeting next week. Because after that, what we are supposed to do is supposed to make sure that we get the recommendations and they go, and there's going to be appropriation on the 27th. And that appropriation that is going to be done by the Minister of Finance is going to be incorporating all the things that we've done. So it means we have to meet next week. Well, we will have to call the department. And as we said yesterday, the two of us won't be around. Just to give a little bit of detail on why I'm going to America, it's something that it has been sponsored by Nestle for me to go there. But it's about nutrition, especially the elementary nutrition in the small babies. I've actually got the whole program here where it's very interesting because they're talking about micronutrients. All there are going to be speakers talking about those things and not comparing breastfeeding and them, but just to understand what micronutrients are all about, what breastfeeding is all about, what these formulas that they have, but a whole lot of speakers that I'm going on that. I'll come back and give you a report as to what were they discussing. It's just a workshop. I'll come back. And so next week you'll meet. I'm going to discuss this with us, which is going to be the probable day, so that they can call the department. We'll decide who's going to lead the committee in those discussions with the department. I'm hoping that whether they answer the question or they don't answer the question, we'll come up with recommendations as a portfolio committee, that these are the recommendations, having looked at the department, having listened to the Auditor General, and we'll have a look at them, and they'll be put in whatever, I don't know whether, I'm very illiterate when it comes to the parliamentary things, the ATC or the whatever. Yeah, so it's going to be published. But I think we need to go that way. There are certain other things that I thought probably we need to talk about, but later on, somebody were discussing that in we are a portfolio committee for health, and there are some people who get sick. So we're supposed to be the leading committee, but we can discuss one day how do we think we can help Parliament as far as sicknesses in Parliament. Not only that we can assist ourselves, because we might not be in that profession, but in being able to connect them to the institutions outside so that they can get help. Obviously, the health issues in Parliament are supposed to be handled by us, but we can discuss another day, much as we're going to discuss on that particular day, which I'm sure it must be before the end of this month. We discuss where do we want to go next year, so that we can put in those things, and we'll discuss all the possibilities. But can I leave it there if there's no other comment? Can I leave it at that we're meeting next week with the department, and then after that making recommendations, and later on we'll meet and look at some of these other things, where are we going to be going, and so on and so on. Members, thank you very much. Okay, let me
So, I think when you talk about Parliament and health, one of the issues that we must discuss is the food that we are eating. I think the people who are feeding us, are killing us. The food. This sandwich, this mayonnaise, this whatever. I mean, they really must give us healthy food if they want us to be healthy. So the day we discuss Parliament, we discuss the cleanliness and the food.
Yeah, to me it's very serious because... I think as a health portfolio committee, we've got the access of dietitians and everybody, even those that are outside. So we'll be able to get somebody who can look at it so that when we talk about it, we're informed as to what can be done and what's the situation. So, but we'll discuss it at that particular time. I suppose even Grace, she's better now. Because she's in the health committee, we organize some doctors to see her. Then you imagine in the other committees who help them, but this is why we're thinking of that. Okay, members, if there are no other contributions, can I say that Uf Yokazi is going to tell you which date you are going to be meeting next week? Uf Yokazi will sit down and look at the date. Though I'm not going to be there, but we'll look at the date and we'll look at who's going to be chairing the committee on that night, acting chair for that particular day.
Minister, can you make some recommendations already? If you would like to make it in order to I'm sure that we have already.
Okay, yeah, that's a suggestion, and I don't think there's anybody who's against it, that you can make recommendations, but some of us are going to wait until we ask all the questions to the department. It's up to you, but those who've got recommendations, you can send recommendations as of now, so that they can be looked at. Thank you. Mbres, you had your hand up? Oh, okay.
I thought we agreed that we didn't see the
She's saying Wednesday.
So, but yesterday I said Wednesday and she said no, Tuesday. Today I said Tuesday as I stated yesterday, now she says no, Wednesday.
Maybe the way we need to handle it, I think.
Why are you so consistently opposed to what I say?
This is the. This is a committee of members. She is assisting members. You can give a suggestion, but she can say, no, because of this administrative thing, it's not going to happen. But the final word is going to come from the members themselves. So that's why I wanted to talk to her, so that she can tell me what are the administrative issues that will probably hamper us on Monday or Tuesday or whatever.
Because after yesterday's meeting, I changed everything on Monday to Tuesday. Because the other thing was, because initially I thought it was going to be Wednesday. So, I'm just asking about whether she can not look into Tuesday.
I think there's a little problem there, which is what she's trying to mention, that we are saying that before we make properly all the recommendations, much as we're going to make some, we depend on the department. Now she's saying, obviously we've got to phone the department, when are you ready? Apparently they've said that they won't be ready on Tuesday, they'll only be ready on Wednesday. And I know why on Wednesday, because the minister's going to be in cabinet, so they'll have all the time to do other things. I think, but it's something that we're going to discuss. And we'll tell you, Eli, we're sorry about the preparation that they've done. It means you're very organized. You prepare 7 days before that I'm going to do this. Some people start today preparing for tonight. Okay. Not that she's going to take a decision. She's just going to make a recommendation that we recommend the date because of this reason. And if you will agree that that date is right. Thank you very much. It's going to probably be Tuesday or Wednesday. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, members. We'll see you on the 22nd.